On a mission to raise problem gambling awareness, featuring Dave Yeager. To many individuals, the mission of bringing awareness to problem gambling does not have a start and end date. For those people, it is a never-ending campaign to speak up and shine a light in an area that is often left in the shadows. Dave Yeager, an Army veteran and someone who identifies as being in recovery from gambling addiction, makes it a part of his work to keep challenging the status quo and break down barriers to providing much-needed education, screening, and treatment. Author of Fall In, a veteran with a gambling addiction, Dave talks about his story and how it drives him to make this work a part of his life mission. Our guest for this episode is Dave Yeager, and he is an 11-year veteran of the United States Army and is in recovery from gambling addiction. Dave is the host of Fall In, the problem gambling podcast for military service members and veterans, and actively advocates for better education, screening, and treatment for problem gambling addiction among these groups. Dave has served on the Military Committee for the National Council on Problem Gambling. You can learn more about Dave Yeager by visiting his website, DaveYeager/fallin.com.
This is Talking Addiction and Recovery, the podcast talking, you guessed it, all about addiction and recovery. Join your host, licensed professional counselor Andrew J. Schreier, as he and his guests break down recovery topics with raw honesty, delving into niche conversations around the topics of substance abuse, mental health, and gambling. We intend to meet individuals where they are on their own personal journey of recovery with dignity, respect, and compassion. We'll do more than talk addiction and recovery. We'll explore it. We're glad you've joined us. Here with today's episode, your host, Andrew Schreier.
Welcome, Dave Yeager, to Talking Addiction and Recovery Podcast. We're finally here and talking.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's been a bit, but we got here.
Yeah, that's how it works. It's like, you know, let's get this going. Let's have you on. Didn't work. Reschedule. Didn't work. You know, we got to talk in person even before doing this. And then you're also busy right now. You're at conferences. You're tabling for your book. You were on panel. So you got a lot going on. You made time for me. So I greatly appreciate that.
No, I appreciate you because I know your schedule's busy too. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me as well.
In a busy month, we're going to talk about one of the reasons why we're talking is this is a busy month for March and Problem Gambling Awareness Month. So before we dive into that, can you just give a little brief overview of, you know, who you are and what you do for the listeners?
Sure. My name is Dave Yeager. I'm an 11-year veteran of the Army and also in recovery for a gambling addiction that I struggled with over the course of starting back in 2007 is when I really, actually 2001 is when it started, and finally took charge of it in 2007, went through a relapse, and then ultimately in 2020, I re-engaged in fully in recovery, and now, you know, regularly attend Gamblers Anonymous. I also now work as a recovery coach and a trainer for military and veteran organizations. I do a lot of speaking on it. You know, I'm completely engaged in what I do now. I'm just one of the happiest people on the planet right now.
Yeah. And I've heard your name before. We've run into each other at different, I think we've ran into each other in two or three like different states now with doing all this. So your name is very familiar in, you know, the gambling treatment and work that we do and talks, and then you released a book. So, you know, kind of where to start with all this, you know, I was thinking, as you say, 2007 seems like a while ago that, you know, really when you say that that's where things really kind of started and took over, it's amazing to think about that because when you sometimes read stories of, you know, people in their recovery and their journey, sometimes I feel like they're kind of, oh, this was like 20 years ago quite a long time ago, but some of your story is pretty recent and fresh and what you've been doing with it. So I'm just curious, how's that been for you with doing that, having, you know, speaking engagements, writing a book, deciding to really, you know, put that out there? And that's a way to say it, is really put yourself out there.
Yeah, you know what? I went through two pretty bad bouts with this, and the decision I made, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with Christina Cook, who does a podcast for women in recovery from gambling. She used the term living her recovery out loud. I made the decision, and this was even before my relapse. I had started to get into this field a little bit. And the reason that I started to do it was I was asked to go down to Washington, D.C., as they were first introducing, you know, for the military, the Gambling Addiction Prevention or GAP Act, right? So I was asked to go down and speak before because I had written my first book. My first book was much shorter, not nearly as intense as this one was. And because of that, they'd asked me to come down and talk about my experiences to help share the need for, you know, education, treatment, recovery within the military community. So it was the first time I'd really gone down and talked about myself in public, and I was nervous. I had little 3x5 index cards in my pocket for different parts of the story. And I realized as I started telling my story, this is therapeutic, right? This means something to me. And even though I ultimately ended up going through a relapse, that part of it stuck with me. And as I engaged even deeper into my recovery, the talks that I do now are far deeper than they were when I first started doing it. But they still have that meaning for me. And there's still times when I'm talking about my story where I feel the pain of the story, right? And to be honest with you, Andrew, I need to feel that pain. That pain is important to me for staying in touch with it, you know, particularly now. So a lot of the reason I do it now is number one, there's a couple reasons I do it. First and foremost, I do it because I remember when I was in my addiction, and I've talked about this a number of times. In the heart of my addiction, I can remember thinking nobody could ever possibly understand what's going through my head right now, because I was living such a Jekyll and Hyde life, you know, of hiding and mystery. And part of me was doing all these great things while part of me was destroying myself, that nobody could understand it. Well, there are people out there who can understand it. And that's what I want people to know, is there's hope. If you think you're the only person experiencing this, you're probably not. And it really, I'm going to be honest, I don't know that it matters what the addiction is, what the problem is. You're probably not the only one experiencing it. And that's why, you know, that's why I share my story, to share that hope and the need to educate people that that hope's there.
And your the title, which you mentioned as part of your background, like Fall in a Veteran with a Gambling Addiction. I mean, you also talk about two issues that don't really combined get a lot of attention. You know, gambling enough doesn't get enough of the, you know, we talk about substance use, mental health, you know, you talk about other things, and gambling is the one that we know is the hardest voice to carry in a room of many other issues. Then you also talk about, you know, specifically with veterans, and that just, it seems like that's an even a harder topic to talk about and to bring up. So can you speak on, you know, that aspect of it, where I think your target is really anyone who listens, or anyone who's been affected by it in any way, but you do have a strong connection with the military side of it, the veteran side of the issue with gambling.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. First of all, I tell my story for anybody who can get benefit from it, no matter where you come from, what no walk of life, what your story is. But I focus heavily on the military and veteran community for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's extremely underserved. So right now in the military, there are protocols in place for somebody who struggles with a drug or alcohol problem, right? Because it's been around long enough that there are established policies that say if someone has an alcohol issue and they're treatable, we can get them back out into the force by doing this, you know, by running them through this treatment program. There's currently nothing like that in place for gambling. So, and even though the policies in certain services are starting to now update to reflect, in 2020, there was one branch in particular, and I'm not going to mention because I don't want to go there. That's not my place to go there. But there was a branch of the service who took their policy manual for drugs and alcohol, and everywhere where you see the word drugs or alcohol, you now see the word gambling next to it. The problem is the clinicians in the system, number one, don't even know it's there, or number two, when they do know it's there, don't know what to do with it. You know, because gambling in the military is not looked at in general as an addiction. It's looked at as a money problem and an effect to readiness, right? And that's hard because to some extent there's truth in that. When you are a person who's addicted to gambling, your tendency is to want money. If you carry a high security clearance and you carry sensitive information, you run the risk of somebody trying to get that information from you and giving you the one thing you want to feed your addiction, which is money. So that part of it needs to be addressed and impacted immediately. I had no security clearance. I was not in danger of giving away any sensitive information, but I was an impact to my unit because I was constantly gambling. I was lying. I was borrowing from my own soldiers and eventually ended up stealing from my unit, right? But it's still treated as a money and a character problem instead of an addiction. And I can even remember my first commander saying to me the first time I got disciplined for it, "I don't know what to do with you." And that wasn't the last time I heard that. So, and then part of that is when you first go into the military, right from day one, when you get off the bus, you're taught leave your problems at the door, right? We have a mission to accomplish. Mission first, mission always. So everything you're dealing with, everything that you're going through needs to be left outside the door so you can accomplish the mission. And in a fighting force that's here to protect our nation, you almost need to have that mentality. The problem is there needs to be somebody on the other end to help you decompress when you get through all that. Once you've accomplished the mission, once you've gone through all that, who's on the other end to say, okay, now, how do we start to break this down? You know, how do we start to process through this so you're not carrying it around? And oftentimes, even if that person is available, the soldier, the airman, the sailor doesn't engage in it because you're brought up in this tough guy mentality. You're brought up in this mission first mentality. That carries over into the veteran years, which now what you're piling on top of it is transition. And this is something you don't hear a lot of talk about. Transition from military life, especially a lot of years in the military, back to civilian life is can be, I'm not going to say is, can be incredibly difficult. You're going from a disciplined mentality where you have rules and regulations to stand behind, right? You have cohesion, and in often cases, a bond that even if you don't like the people you're around, you're bonded with them because you need each other to stay alive in some cases, right? And you've got all, plus you're carrying around weapons of destruction and just, you know, you're allowed to carry these things around. There's all of these things that you move over into civilian life and a lot of this stuff disappears. The cohesion's not there. I remember moving from military. I was a non-commissioned officer, so I led people, right? So if somebody got in trouble, I sat them down in front of me and I said, here's what you did. Here's what regulation you violated and here's how we're going to correct it. I got into civilian life, and I remember the first time one of my employees got in trouble, I was in manufacturing, and I sat him down in front of me, and I said, here's what you did, here's what we're going to do about it, and they said, I'm going to HR. And then the next thing I know, I'm sitting in front of HR, and they're going, well, you can't do things that way. We have certain ways that we need to do. And I'm like, wait a minute, what happened to chain of command? What happened to discipline? Why am I even in this position? You know? And that's just one tiny little piece of a whole bunch of things that you have to adjust to moving to veteran life. So now you take all of this mission first, leave it at the door, you know, the warrior mentality of, you know, I'll never leave a fallen soldier behind. I'll always put the mission first. You know, my problems don't count. And now you carry it over to veteran life where your transition stinks. And the result of that is, and if you look at studies that have been done over the years, military service members and veterans are at almost twice the risk of developing a gambling addiction as the average civilian, as their civilian counterparts. The other part of that is, on average, military service members tend to be 18 to 30-year-old people, most predominantly male. And even though the numbers of females in the military and the number of female gamblers are increasing, it's still predominantly male-driven, predominantly in that age group of about 18 to 30, right? So now you've got the perfect storm, basically. It's a perfect storm, and that's why it's so difficult.
Yeah, and I wonder too, I think some people don't really fully understand like gambling and then in military, you know, sometimes it's almost the same conversation that I have when people wonder about how do people gamble in prison. And it's like, yeah, that happens. Like that's but people kind of struggle to think like, well, how does that occur? And I think a lot of people struggle to think of how does gambling happen in the military? Like, how does that even occur? So for people who don't really understand that, how is it that gambling is either available or is it a part of you know, culture, but how does someone even really engage with that? Because it's different in many ways, but also it's not as different as you might think. Like, well, there's no way they don't have that. Like, you can gamble in the military.
Yeah. And I'm going to give you a couple of different examples. First and foremost, I have a very good friend of mine who is in recovery for gambling addiction, who was stationed, who was deployed to Iraq, right? While you're deployed in Iraq or Afghanistan, there are no casinos all around you to be able to go to and gamble. And most likely you don't have phone access to sports betting or anything like that. Well, they had a little plywood room back room where they played poker. They were a cleanup team. So if a team went out and got into an engagement, and there was a bunch of stuff that was left behind or whatever, their job was to go out and clean up the situation and basically patrol the area, get everything cleaned up and go back. So there was a lot of downtime in between these situations. So where they were in their camp, they built this little room and they basically made it like a speakeasy. It was a little plywood boarded off room where unless you were part of the club, you weren't getting in, and they let you in and they almost constantly played poker, almost constantly. And even if they didn't have money, they would gamble on promissory notes. They would gamble on, you know, certificates to be able to go get a haircut or to go do something. They would,
which
gamble.
Is value. That's what people sometimes misses. Yeah. To different populations. Like I look, that's, I'm so glad you talk about this, because I look at, people think kids can't have a problem with gambling because what money do they have? People who are incarcerated can't, but you know, kids can gamble with something of value. I remember kids would gamble with like clothes, you know. Yeah. Like when I worked in a group home, like, oh, I like that shirt, like let's bet something on it. And then incarceration, like they bet with commissary, you know, or like, it's not just, people get caught up in it must be a large amount of money for there to be a problem. But you just touched on in this, like value is very different to someone in military. It's not going to be necessarily a big stack of cash, but there's value in things there that can be gambled with.
That's so funny you say that, because I do a lot of times when I talk about this and I talk about gambling in the definition, and I go through it even with clinicians who work with them, because I think it's important, is I always put up the words risk, value, right, and reward. So I say you're risking something of value for something of potentially greater value, you know, for the reward of greater value, with no guarantee that you're going to get that greater value. And I always say the same thing. Please notice that not once through that whole thing did I use the word money. You know?
Or how little. I always tell people that the money is like the shock value to people, mm-hmm. like when they hear a certain amount of money. But I always, when I do trainings or talks, I always try to make that point of like, that's not really a diagnostic criteria. That's not really accurate, because it's why we miss certain populations. It's why we miss, you know, why a teenager could have a problem, why we miss people who are incarcerated, why we miss people mm-hmm. who are in the military, is because our idea of someone with a problem gambling is someone who's at like a casino or, you know, betting with large amounts of money or more and more money. And that's not what we're really looking at with some of these specific populations.
Yeah, and it's about increasing risk, not necessarily increasing money.
Right.
And let's talk about casino gambling and that sort of thing. In years and years and years ago, back in, you know, 1930s, 40s, whatever, there were casinos on military bases throughout the United States, right? And then eventually, because of some of the problems that were coming up, because of them, they took them completely out of military bases. But in the 1980s, the Air Force and Army requested that they be put back in overseas bases as a form of entertainment, which they then did. And they still exist to this day on fixed military installations. Now, you won't find them in Afghanistan, Iraq, anything like that. But Germany, Japan, Korea, where I was, they're there, right? And they're fun. They collect money for morale, welfare, and recreation, which is the arm of the DOD that provides recreational services for soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines stationed overseas. It's great. It's a great program. It gives them trips they can go on. It gives them things they can do. These machines, and at one point there were over 3,000 of them overseas, at one point were generating upwards of $130 million per year, right? $130 million per year. There's two things with that. I don't have a problem with making money for service members to be able to do things. Here's where my concern was. Number one, all of that money is coming from service members, their family members, DOD civilians. That's where all the money's, it's coming from their own people. But number two, and the more important part to me, is not one dime of that has gone into educating, screening, or treating for gambling disorder. Okay. Right. And I remember walking into the rooms in Korea, which is where I fell into my addiction. I don't ever remember seeing a sign on the wall that says, these are the signs and symptoms of a gambling addiction. I don't ever remember on the days when I was there for 8, 9, 10 hours straight, somebody walking up to me and going, hey, you've been here a long time. Is everything okay? I don't ever remember that happening. And even the people I talk to today who've experienced that say the same thing. So I don't know that it's changed a whole lot. Am I going to guarantee it? I don't know. I'm not there. But what I hear, the murmurings I hear, is that it hasn't changed. And then part three of that relates to more recent changes. You know, 2018, when the Supreme Court said, okay, states, now you can decide whether or not your state does sports gambling, online casino, all that. Well, there are military bases all over the United States. And you get this impression with the military when you see movies and stuff that they're always on the move, that they're always on call. There is a lot of
doing like routines, drills, like there's
not even at that, but always waiting busy for transportation, waiting in line for medical services, you know, times when there literally is nothing going on. I mean, like extreme boredom. We would go out to the firing range, right? And you'd fire your weapon and you'd get through your qualification. You still had to wait for 20 people to qualify. You still had to wait for transportation to show up. So there were times I'd be sitting out there for an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, and doing nothing, literally nothing, right? Nowadays, we have our phones, and if you have access to the internet and you can access it, guess what? Now those soldiers are sitting out there waiting for transportation. Now they can start betting on games. Now they can do a multi-leg parlay. Now they can do all of, you know, online casino. If it's available to them, now there's some places where it's not, where it's blocked, and that's good, I think. But in the places where it's not, guess what? Now you have that opportunity. So it's all over. And you're right. It's not just about money, but you also know that money is probably the largest catalyst for the addiction, you know, even though it's not always about the money.
Yeah. So. And as you're talking about it too, you know, I think of top down, you know, change in needs, but also trying to reach out to the person that is struggling now. You know, like we can't always wait for the bigger changes to occur or the shift in how we're going to address it. So I do want to ask you, you know, about that, because, you know, it's different, you know, and you talk about the transition as well. Like I've been kind of in a unique position as a counselor, you know, where sometimes I have a client who I don't know their background until they come in and then they start sharing it. That's sometimes where all of a sudden, you know, I remember some that I've had where they completed their service. They came home. I remember the families thought everything was going to be different now that the person returned. And it's not that simple. You know, it's not that easy. You know, I remember this one couple I worked with where, you know, the wife was doing so much while the husband was gone. And then when he came home, there was a thought from her about relief that like she wasn't doing this all by herself, but he really struggled to do some basic things. And when I talked to him, he was like, you know, I'm used to having someone tell me what to do. I'm used to having someone direct me or schedule this with me. But he talked a lot about, you know, once he left, that transition period was so difficult. And how do we, as like a profession, or if we're trying to give some services or give some help, how do we approach a population like the military or individuals who have a military background? Because I think one thing that people are sometimes hesitant to do is they feel like they can't do anything because they didn't come from that background. So like if I didn't serve, I don't know how I can help this person because I didn't go through it or I didn't live that. Me, I just try to be a good counselor. You know, I just try to listen and give a safe space. And it's not about me having the experience. But I think when you do look at populations like military, armed forces, you know, first responders, you know, some of that is I think a lot of people step back because they feel like they can't make a connection to that population. But I don't know if like that's necessarily true.
No, I don't think it is true. And I think there's a way to approach it. And you spoke to it a little bit with what you do is first and foremost to say, look, I've not been down the path you've been down. So I don't understand a lot of what you've been through and a lot of your mentality. So I'm going to need you to help me. I'm going to need you to be the expert so I can better understand it. If you make the first responder, the veteran, the service member, the expert in their own journey, they're more likely to share with you what that journey looks like and feels like. So that's number one, right? You know, if you sit, and the one thing you want to avoid is you want to avoid saying things like, were you in war and did you shoot at people and all this violent kind of stuff? No.
Unnecessary, like questioning, like,
right.
Like, you know, fat, like digging for things that we don't really need to dig in this area.
Right.
Create an environment where they can share with you what they, and they'll tell you, like when I said, hey, well, what, tell me about it. You know, what'd you like? It's not always what I thought it would be. It's not always what I realized it is. There's so many different things that go on and occur in different jobs and roles. It's not just everything you see on a movie.
And that's the perfect answer right there. That's the perfect approach is, look, you can't take this from a, from this is what I've seen on TV or movies approach. If you try to assume that you know what that person's been through, you're going to lose them very quickly, 9 times out of 10, especially with a service member or a veteran, right? If you more become the student, right, you are the expert from the counseling perspective. You're the expert from once you've reached that level with them, guiding them or showing them a path that they can walk down. What we're not the expert on is who this person is and where they came from. So the minute you allow them to open that door and become that expert, now they'll open the door and allow you to be an expert at what you do, right? And then I think the key to it is just find a point of connection, right? Just find some point of human connect. We're all human. So we can all find a point where we can connect on a human level. And if you can find that point, now you've got something. That's my opinion.
Yeah. And it's great, you know, when you can do that. And I love the point about having them be the expert, because I believe that for like everyone that I work with, you know, that no matter what I know about you know, substance use, what I know about mental health, what I know about gambling, that when it comes down to the person and knowing who's in front of me, like they are the ultimate expert of their mm-hmm. life. I really avoid and don't like when it's, well, I kind of know, I've heard stories like this before. I know you based off of that.
Right.
It's yeah, sure. You may have had similarities or a similar background, but I mean, no one's story is the same.
Right.
And it's all different. I mean, someone else could write a book about their gambling and they could have military in their background, and it could be completely different than what yours is.
It likely will be.
Yeah.
But there will also be many points along there that interweave mm-hmm. connection points, you know? And whether you've got military experience or not, you can find points in that conversation and in that, you know, when they start talking about maybe how they are struggling to connect with their loved ones, or they're talking about, you know, everybody, you can connect at multiple levels on connecting with other people. I'm struggling talking to my wife because my life is so different now. Okay, well, here's a point we can start to talk about. Now, here's where you, as the counselor, we've gone beyond the military and now we've gotten to the human side of it, you know, and that's where I think the connection's made. But allowing them to be the expert on their own journey is, I just think it breaks down barriers much more quickly.
Do you see, or I guess hope to see, you mentioned there was changes with, like, if there's a issue with alcohol or drugs, there's a program for that. You know, you mentioned one where there's one for gambling. I imagine there wasn't always a program for alcohol and drugs that didn't happen automatically. But as we progress and we learn more, we see the impact, what it's doing. Have you been seeing like a shift in, we got to do more to help? Are people still just not sure how we how we do that. Like, I'd like to have this gambling program, but we also don't know really how to bring it into military culture. Like, how, what are you seeing as far as some changes or future insights into how we're trying to improve things or improve services?
There are groups and organizations, and they're more peripheral in the military community, that are starting to bring people in to teach them about this addiction. They're starting to admit, we don't understand it the way we would like to. And they're bringing organizations in. I've worked with the military committee for the National Council on Problem Gambling. We've done education with certain groups. I work with Kindbridge Research Institute. We've done education with certain groups. And they're more on the periphery of things, but it's beginning. There's murmurs, right? The talk is starting to happen. Now, there's still a large core at the center of all this that feels unbudgeable right now, right? So we're chipping away from the outside. We're Andy Dufresne in Shawshank, right? With the soap hammer digging the tiny little hole for the tunnel, right? But it's got to start somewhere. And I think that we're further along than we were even when I started doing this. That felt like, I felt like an impenetrable wall. Now it at least feels like we're making some progress and we've got some ears. And as we create more of those ears and we create more of that curiosity and we start to educate more, I think more people will come on board with it. But it's going to take time. You know, it is. It's going to take I don't think this is going to happen overnight. Unfortunately, like you saw with tobacco, like you saw with alcohol, like you see now with opioids, right? It's going to take pain and blood for people to really start to open up and dive into this. You know, and what I mean by that is it's a shame that I even have to say this, but it takes enough stories of people suing because of suicides, or, you know, enough theft or enough news coverage that comes out to where all of a sudden, you know, the organizations are like, okay, we can't afford not to step into this anymore. You know, and that's what I mean by paying it in blood. And it's unfortunate that I even have to say that. And I really hope it doesn't come to that. But my sense is that's what it's going to take to get there.
Yeah, it's really hard. I always talk, and I just posted this on LinkedIn yesterday because there was the story about famous baseball player whose interpreter was stealing money for gambling. And I posted about it mostly because when you see stories about gambling problems or issues, it's usually a one person headline. You know, like, this one person got in trouble, this one person got arrested, this one person went to jail. They're very individual stories, which, you know, as a therapist, and even with the theme with Problem Gambling Awareness Month being every story matters, like, I do believe that. I do believe, like, every single person's story matters. However, the challenging part with that is it's really hard for that one voice of what's going on to carry when you're dealing with headlines that are like thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions. And that's where I in one of my trainings with gambling, I always talk about paying attention to headlines, because when you read the ones about gambling, they're pretty infrequent. They kind of look like they're one-offs. They're located in a small section somewhere, but it usually involves maybe two people are involved, like one or two.
Right. But
the other headlines about substance use, mental health, you know, suicide, everything is the number is greater, which draws more attention and need. And I understand that, because it's like, look at all this.
Right.
Gambling, it never receives that kind of attention.
I think part of that is the fact that this addiction, as opposed to a drug or alcohol problem, is so much easier to hide.
Right.
You know, and we don't see, you know, it's drugs and alcohol. And I'm not saying that they're better, or anyone's better, worse than the other, or whatever. What I'm saying is it's harder to hide that, because there's a physical manifestation of what's going on there. You know, with gambling, I lived perfectly normal life from what everybody else could tell about me. Right. Meanwhile, my guts are being ripped apart inside, until it finally manifests to the point where, yeah, the the little old administrator at the church walks away with multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars, or the sports guy starts betting on something. You know, when you're there, it's that old analogy of the iceberg. By the time it reaches the point where it reaches the news, right, you're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. You're not seeing the years and years of buildup and all the stuff that's happening beneath it. You know, whereas with drugs and alcohol, maybe you start to see that sooner because the signs and symptoms become, it manifests itself differently. I don't want to say I'm an expert with that, but that's just been my experience in talking to people and in my own journey, is that it's so much easier to hide. I was able to hide it right up to the point where I was almost ready to make my fifth suicide attempt, you know, and nearly did. But I had hidden it for so long, it was just, nobody knew. And when I finally came clean about it, it was a blindside. My poor wife was blindsided when I told her what I was doing. She could not believe that I was that person. So,
I usually call it hidden in plain sight, because yeah, it can be right in front of us yet still hidden.
Yeah.
You know, versus other things, if you see it, it's like you can call it out. You can, hey, this, you know, someone who's drinking, and you can see how it's affecting them, and
right.
Right there, you know, you could not even know the person, be like, I think this person's had like way too much. Yeah. You know, you see someone using substances and like, oh, you see it, you see drugs, that's drugs. Like that's, it's so there. But when you see gambling, the culture side of it, and how, you know, it's just, it's out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you can have a table full of people, you know, gambling, and it's 9 out of 10. Might be social and no issues at all, but like there's one in there that could be having serious problems with it. So it's like right there, but yet we don't always know or address that person's there and struggling with something.
It's even worse now with the increase in online and mobile sports betting. I had somebody that I worked with that said he used to, most of his friends, and this is very common now with the crowd under 30 years old, and so many of them now bet sports on their phone, right? And he said he's out with a crowd of his friends, and his friends are, you know, putting $5 down here or a couple bucks down there. He's sitting right next to them, interacting with them like everything's normal, but he's draining his bank account while he's sitting there next to them, talking to them and having a conversation with them. He's draining his bank account, and you know, his whole mood is sinking to the pit, but yet nobody around him would know it. He's still sitting there having fun. That's how easy this is to hide.
Yeah. That's that hidden in plain sight is always,
yeah,
just, you know, it's hard. And that's why I try to teach, you know, people on paying attention to the, you know, the shame, that you can kind of read on people, or the distress, you know, the, you know, you can see when someone seems to be having fun versus when someone is like, this doesn't look fun, you know, like mm-hmm. that's what you, there's something else going on here. So I want to get back to your book and talk a little bit more about that, because, you know, there's not a lot of books out there on gambling. You know, they probably release one. This is probably not a real statistic, but it's almost like once every year, some book comes out, but it's nothing like the other fields of like mental health, substance use, and all that. It's very, you know, rare to read a memoir or a book about someone writing about their gambling. It's not that often. When you wrote it, you really went through, you know, it was a very, I kind of felt like I was joining you along where you were and your travels and what was going on. Is that how you wanted to design it, where you kind of want to just give people a sort of like a time capsule snapshot of like, let me take you along this journey and kind of show you where I've been and what happened, and give people like a really, because it's like the chapters are so great where you can read a page or two or three and it kind of captures that moment and it moves on. So I feel like it's a great transition from where you were and what was going on. What was your thinking or your ideas of, you know, how you wanted to structure this and kind of how you wanted to share your story?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you because you hit the nail on the head of what I was trying to convey. And what I mean by that is, I mean, yes, it's a linear tale of my journey through addiction, into recovery, back into addiction, and ultimately to where I am now, right? But the more important thing that I was trying to convey in this book, other than the tale, was the feeling, right? So I wanted you to come on. I wanted this to be you and I sit down outside by a campfire or inside wherever, and you just ask me, tell me about your life, and me telling you about my life to the point where you can feel what I'm describing to you. When I'm describing the things that I went through, I want people to get a sense of what it's really like for the disordered gambler to go through this addiction and to go through the things that I've gone through and other people have gone through. And the reason I want that is because if you can connect to those feelings, you can have a better understanding of what this addiction really means, right? So that's why I wrote it this way. There were times, and I said this recently in a podcast, there were times as I was writing this book, I was in tears as I was writing it, but I needed to be. I had to feel this when I was writing it because there's no way you could feel it if I wasn't feeling it.
Yeah,
if all
good
I did
point.
Was do a description of what went on, you would have read it as a description of what went on. If I wrote it with feeling and put the energy of what it felt like into it, you're going to feel that energy, you know, at some level. And that's the connection I wanted to make. So, you know, I wanted you to feel what it felt like going through so that the person that's out there that feels alone or feels like nobody could understand what they're going through can connect with it and say, okay, maybe I'm not alone. Maybe I there is hope for me, which is why I started and ended the book with the exact same phrase, which is, this is a story of hope. Even though a lot of the story was about the destruction and the things that went on, it was still about hope because I went from a point of a low point of not believing anybody could ever understand me to a point of understanding that, yep, people can understand me and I can get better and I can recover and I can be the person I want to be. So yeah, I wanted to convey the feeling as much as the words.
Yeah, it felt very genuine, authentic. This is how I'm telling the story. This is how it is. You know, welcoming readers to join alongside it, but also not trying to, you know, how do I say this? But not trying to make the story fit the reader. You just wanted more to invite the reader to learn your story and to be to be open to it and connect with it. And I think you do a great job of it. I think a lot of people who military side, you know, gambling side in general, you're right. For people who don't know that or have that background or experience, like they get a better understanding of it. They get a better glimpse into a world that's not theirs, but something that they can connect to or relate to, or someone that they know. It really is inviting for the readers to like join alongside. I think of almost, you know, a show or a movie where the you now takes me back and we're walking through all these moments and times, and you're just kind of the narrator of what's happening. And I think that's a very, you know, unique perspective and journey. And it takes a lot to invite strangers into that, you know, like that's not an easy thing to, you know, put yourself out there and share those things. You know, that's tough to do, but you did it in a way for people to learn about it and have that hope.
Cool. And yeah, and you hit it on the head. The movies, the books, the stories that I most connect with are the ones where I feel like I'm along with them for the ride, that I'm along with the journey, you know, with them for the journey. And that's what I wanted from this. I wanted people to go on the journey with me at their level of connection and understanding. You know, I didn't want them to be me. I just wanted them to go along with me and feel what I was feeling, at least for a moment, you know? So yeah, I'm so glad you got that out of it, because that's exactly what I was trying to convey when I wrote this. This had to be, and I said it multiple times I was writing it. I forced none of it. None of this was forced writing. All of this was, if it wasn't coming up for me in that moment, I would put it aside. I would sit it down until I could feel it. And once I started feeling it again, then I would write, you know. So there are parts of it, small parts of it that are filled in, but not a lot, not very much.
And you also, you write the book, you publish it, you release it. You're also, you know, talking about it. You're at conferences, at mm-hmm. tables, you know, sitting there and engaging with people right there about your story and your book. I mean, that takes a whole nother level of, you know, interaction and engaging with people to, you know, this is my story. It's right here. Mm-hmm. That's a lot, you know, that takes a lot of courage from where I sit to have that right there. It's a lot of vulnerability to
it is. Do that. And I'm going to be honest with you. I used to feel that vulnerability a lot more. I still feel it. Don't misunderstand me. But that vulnerability now is strength for me, you know, because it's, I don't fear it. I'm not ashamed of my journey. I feel the guilt of the things that I've done still, but I'm not ashamed of who I am. I know that underneath of all the things that I did and all the actions I took and all the people that I hurt, there was a good person, right? And if I don't see that good person, if I'm not willing to share my story, then I'm hiding from that person. Right. So I share it with the understanding that, yes, there are going to be some people who hear that story and go, yeah, okay. And that's okay. That people will take it the way they take it, but it's for them to understand, but it's for me to heal. So there's two parts of the process. And every time I tell my story, there's parts that I still cringe when I'm telling, but it's healing for me. It's therapeutic for me. And not everybody can do this. And I do not recommend that everybody just pour your guts out on paper or in telling your story. If it's going to be detrimental to your own health or your own recovery, don't do it. But if you're somebody who feels like you can benefit from it, and again, I refer to some of the other podcasters that are out there that have done the same thing, or people that have told their story on podcasts or in person and that type of thing, there are people out there not afraid to do it. And they're speaking for a larger group of people who may not be comfortable doing it for themselves.
And a lot of different ways too, you know, like writing a book, being on a podcast, like a panel at a conference, you know, like there's a lot of ways now for people to share their story and to, for all of us to realize that, you know, all those stories matter. You know, there's never it's too many stories like that's, those are the stories that we need to keep hearing to know about what's going on, how it's impacting people. And, you know, I kind of want to be able to end this on talking about, you know, where we go from here, because it is Problem Gambling Awareness Month. You know, this is a busy month for a lot of us in conferences, talks, but for a lot of us too, like it doesn't just end because March is over, you know, like it really doesn't end for a lot of us. Cause we do this all around, but we need people to join us a lot with us. You know, we can't do what we need to do by ourselves. We don't have that bandwidth, that capacity, the resources. So for me, I always like think about what I'm doing for this month, but I'm always trying to think too about, you know, this year and looking forward, like what is it that I want to try and do, or what am I trying to look at? So for you, you know, I'm curious with everything that you are doing, where are your thoughts for, you know, what you're trying to accomplish or do or work towards with, you know, this year still that it's not the end because it's March is over, but which direction are you heading in or hoping to really accomplish?
You know, I'll start with this, and you said it yourself. Problem gambling awareness doesn't end at the end of a month, right? Yes, there's a very concentrated amount of work that goes on during Problem Gambling Awareness Month, and rightly so. It's a good springboard month, but it doesn't end there. For me, this work goes on year-round, and it's passion work for me. So this is not work. It doesn't feel like work. What I do doesn't feel like work. So my vision moving forward for what I want to be and what I want to do is, you know, I try to stay to one lane because there's so many of us doing this in different areas. I picked a lane that I thought I would be the most passionate about, and that's the military and veteran space, right? Yes, I work with, as a recovery coach, I work with multiple people in recovery from all different walks of life, right? And I love what I do there. I don't want to give that up. But the work for me that's the most meaningful is starting to raise awareness around this in the military community. I'm working with an organization that's started to work with ROTC groups, right? Think about that for a second. You're taking a group of leaders who are not yet out in the field in the military, and you're planting the seed of what gambling addiction looks like in that group. This group's now going to get out there and be different from the last group of leaders that was out there because now they have new knowledge. They're armed with new knowledge, right? So I want to do more of that. I want to educate more people. I want to start to teach people about the power of this addiction, right? And the fact that it's affecting a lot more people than others realize. And as you begin to educate more and you begin to get more of this knowledge out there and people begin to realize that this is an addiction and that there is help, you're going to see people coming out of the woodwork. And then we start preparing the clinical side, the people who are taking care of these people. How do we care for these people? Right? Because again, even when I was in the military and I broke down and I was let out of the military because of my addiction, I was sat in front of a counselor and they talked about drugs and alcohol and they talked about mental health and they talked about suicide, but they never once mentioned the word gambling to me. So, you know, even though the policy wording is starting to get out there, the clinicians that treat, you know, military service members aren't really trained on it. So let's get them trained. Let's start working in that direction. On the VA side of the house, they're the oldest residential gambling treatment program in the United States of any kind is housed at a VA facility and was started by the Department of Veterans Affairs. Yet, if you poll clinicians throughout the entirety of the U.S. that work for the VA, right, there's only a handful of percentage of them that actually know that this place exists. So yeah, we need to educate
more people. They got ahead of the game, but then sort of fell back. <It's
Yeah>. Like, because became the stepchild addiction.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It became the side, and even today, there are struggles within that system to keep the importance of that program alive. It's still alive. It's not going anywhere, but it's not being advertised or talked about the way that it needs to because it's just like, oh, okay, well, that's gambling. You know, we have more important things. We have drugs and alcohol we need to deal with, you know? So, you know, it's just, I don't know. The education. If you ask me, what is my next step? Educate, 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 teach as many people as I can about this addiction. And as more people come on board and get more interested in it, we can start to spread who's going to do what. Now we start to leverage ourselves, right? Now you start to get more people coming out going, okay, how do I be part of the solution instead of part of the problem? Well, funny you should ask, you know? And that, I think, in my mind, and I don't know, I could be nuts, but in my mind, that to me is the path forward.
Yeah, and you've been doing it. I know you probably think at times it's not enough or you could do more, but you've brought awareness a lot to gambling. You've shined a light on the need to address it with a very important population with the military. You know, your work is seen. You know, your work has been doing things, and I don't have a doubt it will continue to do things. It does take a lot of persistence and not giving up. you know, keeping at it with little spoon by little spoon of
right,
getting through and getting to that point. And you know, I'm hopeful, you know, even work that we do together, that you know, we'll get to that point. We just keep doing what we're doing. So it's enjoyable when we get to do that stuff together. You know, all the listeners here are not going to realize that you and I will keep talking. We're going to keep seeing each other at right. places. There's going to be conversations we get to keep having. So it'll for you and me, this isn't over, but you know, what you're doing does matter. It's making a difference. You know, your story matters, your work matters. So it's greatly appreciated for everything you've done with it. And you know, when I think about gambling, when I think about, you know, military population, you know, your name's up there for who I would say is someone that, you know, you go to for, you know, expert level you know, education or services. So you're doing a lot with it. And I think it just needs to be said, because it sometimes, with everything that we talked about, you probably don't always hear that.
Well, and let me say, I very much appreciate that. I'm honored to do what I do. It truly is an honor for me to do what I do. And to hear that kind of feedback means more to me than you know. The other thing I'll say to that is, we need more of me out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Clone yourself. That's
right.
That's what people told me.
I had somebody from the New York Council, you know him, Jonathan Crandall, calls me the unicorn in the room. Right. I love the honor. I love being called that, but I don't want to be the unicorn. I want to be one among many.
Yeah.
You know, and if I can become the small voice in a big room, hey, then we're doing something. But until I become the small voice in the big room, I'm going to be the big voice in the small room. So
amazing. I'm looking forward to it, to more work together, to see more of what you do. And, you know, for the listeners, you know, we'll have links to where they can get your book and find out more about connecting with you and anyone that's got interest in gambling or even military populations. It's going to be strongly encouraged that they reach out to you and connect with you, because that's where we can start to do great things. So
would it be okay if I mentioned my website,
which has go ahead.
Links to resources for service members and veterans? It's just www.daveyager.com. So it's daveyager-fallin.com.
Yeah. And we'll have links to
awesome.
Websites. We'll have ways that people can connect with you, with what you do. I find your stuff on LinkedIn a lot too, with how busy you are, but we'll make sure the audience gets that. So I really want to just thank you, Dave, for joining. This has been a very timely topic to discuss. The military population and having that discussion, I think, is amazing too, because it hasn't really been one that is been talked about on the podcast, and having it connected with gambling has been tremendous, which, you know, shining light and building awareness. So this was a very valuable talk that we've had. And I think a lot of listeners are going to have a lot of takeaways from it. So can't thank you enough for joining.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate you. I appreciate the work that you do, because you're out there as well. And you're pounding the pavement almost on a daily basis out there, spreading the word. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here and be able to share here. So thank you.
Yeah. So we'll have links to everything. Well, keep looking forward to what Dave's doing. It's a lot. Find the link to his book. It's amazing. I bought a bunch of copies to give out to people. So clearly I'm a fan of it, and we'll just keep seeing what you're doing. And an audience, thanks for joining us, and hope you learned something.
You've been listening to Talking Addiction and Recovery with Andrew J. Schreier. We're so glad you've joined us, and invite you to connect further with the show and these topics at www.andrewjschreier.com. That's Andrew J. S-C-H-R-E-I-E-R.com. You can also email us directly at talkingaddictionandrecovery@gmail.com and connect on social media, Instagram at Talking Addiction and Recovery, Facebook Talking Addiction and Recovery Podcast, and Twitter at @TalkAR_podcast. To stay connected and never miss an episode, be sure to like, rate, and subscribe. Until next time, friends, let's keep talking addiction and recovery.